completed exam two, and I believe I have evidence that your class is populated with mutants mostly. I don't think I've ever seen a distribution like this. Well, I know I have never seen a distribution quite like this. There were 11 hundreds. I didn't believe it, so I started looking at them. And I didn't look at all of them, but the ones I looked at were hundreds. And the mean was something like 84. That's strange enough to make me question my exam. And I actually went to Joe Eberly and I said, well, what's with this class? And he said that, because many of you were in 143, he said, it was sort of a normalish class. Frank said it was a strong class. So I don't know. I think the exam was a pretty reasonable exam. So clearly, the message really is, I can understand, clearly the class as a whole is doing very well. All right. And so I would imagine that many of you who have grades down here might be very concerned because you have such a big cluster up here, okay? And so that's a little bit my job. I always said when I talk to a class that if everybody does really fabulous work, then I slide the curve. I don't have a quota of numbers of A's and stuff. And right now, as far as I can tell, I mean, I spot checked some over here too, okay? And when I looked at some of those, you know, there was a silly mistake. There were some silly mistakes that cost some points, but those students are clearly doing okay. So right now, you guys are doing really well, and I'm going to end up having lots of A's and high B's and stuff. So I don't know what to say. You know, if you're losing lots of, you really need to look at things. Clearly, a few of you are losing more points than you want, and there may be some real holes in your understanding that you need to check into. And obviously, if you're very low, I have to look very carefully at what I think you're learning based on what you missed. And I'll certainly be doing that for the final. But just because the mean is here doesn't mean you're looking at C's here. Okay, I want you to know that message I want to make very clear to you. Any questions? I'll hand them back. As always, you should check what you missed, and you should think about what it means in terms of your understanding, silly mistakes, etc. So, you know, I don't know what to say. You guys are embarrassing me a little bit. Not be able to show my... Or maybe I'll just say, obviously, I finally learned how to teach.
I'm just a little confused about what you mean when you're saying that if you're, like, in the lower half of the range, not necessarily looking at, like, C's.
Well, normally what happens is I have sort of a more normal distribution. And that more normal distribution tends to peak, say, at 70-ish. So it looks more, there might be a bit of a tail here, and there might be a bit of a tail here, but I sort of have a bit of a cluster like this, okay? And what I'm sort of used to doing with that is, I mean, I'll go and I'll look at that, and usually students that are sort of on the mean there basically are clearly in the course, they're clearly doing the work, they're clearly understanding a lot of the stuff. They either have one hole that has contributed to a loss of some points, or they've made a number of silly mistakes, okay? And sort of that kind of thing is more or less B work. So what I'm used to doing is I would then set the mean at a B, and I would have sort of a broad range, okay, depending on the class a little bit. And clearly if you're up here, you'd be getting A's, and if you're down here, you know, sort of on the curve, you know, you start to have more holes, more mistakes, but that would be sort of a C range. And if you're a tail over here, then we have to look, you know, do you fail or do I look carefully to see how much you're picking up. So I don't feel constrained to continue the curve going down, and anybody that's 10 points below obviously gets an F. I have to look and see if they're getting stuff. So that's how I'm used to operating. And I don't really have a quota, but usually it turns out that I get about half the class in the B range and about 20% of a quarter in the A range and about that in the C range. That's sort of typical, okay? And I always say, if everybody does that much better, then I'll just slide the curve. And I think I'm in that situation with your class so far. We'll see what happens with the final. But as a class as a whole, you're doing really well. and just keep doing it. I mean, so the message is, one, I'm not married to quota numbers, and two, what that means is if you're in this range where you've lost some points, you should think about what it means, but it doesn't really mean you're in serious trouble in this class, okay, at all. Okay? So it's good news. All right? What a bunch of mutants. 1100s. What is that crap? I mean, I usually will have students in here, but there's room for silly mistakes, guys. Yeah, look, I couldn't believe it. I was thinking, oh, Mayor is just way too easy a grader. But I'm not sure about that. Okay, so it's great. The other thing I have up here, though, is that we do have the presentations coming up. And if you look at the syllabus, they actually start relatively soon. So the 4th, the 9th, and the 11th will be the 3 days. We have finite time in each class time, so I believe at most we can really have 3 groups go per day. All right? So I need each group to think about what their constraints and their other things are, which date they prefer to present. And then I need a rank order list of which date you most prefer, which date you would your second choice, and which is your third choice. Probably most of you would go for the 11th, but that's never quite obvious. Actually, I've had groups really want to go first for different things, so it really depends on what's going on with you. At any rate, if everybody wants to go the 11th, then clearly many of you will not get accommodated. But I will do my best to accommodate your top choice. Okay, and I would like you to mull that over and try to get that answer through your spokesperson of your group to me pretty soon so we can actually assign the times. And then you know what target date you have to shoot for. Okay? In fact, I'd really like to have those target dates set by next Tuesday. So let's try to get that information back. Anything else about the presentations or... Just remind me before I normally end to hand your exams back. I haven't posted the solutions yet. I will try to do that this afternoon. It's sort of a busy week for me, so I'll try to get those up today. You should always check the grading and check what you did. It's part of the learning process, and you may find a mistake in the grading. Let me know. Okay? All right. So, we're into it now. We were looking at Maxwell's equations, and when we took Maxwell's equations and pulled a couple of vector calculus identities out, one can take Maxwell's equations, the differential form, and rewrite them into these two equations. Each of these equations, they're vector equations, so they basically represent 3 scalar equations each. But if you look at them, you have... a second spatial derivative here and constants and a second time derivative here, and basically that's a wave equation. So you have a wave equation in B and a wave equation in E. If you look at them just this way, they look completely independent, but of course you, in Maxwell's equations, remember that you have an equation that relates E to the time dependence of B, and you have one that relates B to the time dependence of E. And those are coupled equations, and that stuff, those relationships don't go away just because we ripped these things apart and came up with these relationships as well. So we see that E and B are wave equations. And in doing this, we did not use any boundary conditions. So this is basically true. What these kinds of waves look like depends on your boundary conditions. Okay, but there are some things that we can say. We can say we have the wave equations. We know that they're coupled equations because E and B mix. And then we might ask, what can we learn? Because if these are wave equations, we can hypothesize that we have harmonic solutions. It could be a very complicated harmonic solution, right? Because this wave equation is sort of a three-dimensional thing. we use Maxwell's equations, which are just always true with E and D. So those are true with in general. And then we can impose some boundary conditions that might allow us to actually have some intuition about what's going on. So that's what we started, what we did a good bit of last time. So the physical situation that I looked at was we had a source of light very far away, which means the light that's coming you can think of as a wavefront, spherical wavefront from the source, but if you're very, very far away, as it comes to you, it looks like a plane wave. So that's really the constraint. We can consider that it's a plane wave, and at no loss of generality, we will just say that the electric field is oriented in a certain direction, so that we just have some way to be quantitative with our mathematics. So we'll assume that the electric field in this plane wave that's coming in is oriented in the y direction. And that is what we mean when we talk about polarization. It is the orientation of the electric field in the wave as it comes to your eye if the wave is coming at you. And so when we make that choice and we then pop that solution, the harmonic solution with this orientation, into Maxwell's equations, we discovered a few things. One of the things we found is that E and B are transverse, which means if the wave is propagating this way, E and B are oriented in this plane. Okay? The other thing we found was that if we choose E to be this way, B turns out to be at right angles to it. And that's going to be true regardless of where E is. What we found was that B is at right angles to E. So they are transverse and mutually perpendicular. In this, as we looked at this, we also found that E and B are in phase, and that they have amplitudes that are related by the speed of light. Okay? So that's what we have. And now I'd like to basically take that and look at it more carefully. So, yes?
Is there a right-hand rule for the way that we've been traveling with E and B?
Yeah, we'll get there later today, actually. But yes, if you use a right-hand rule and put your finger, you basically do E cross B. So if you put your fingers along E and curl it into B, your thumb will go in the direction of the way it propagates. And, yeah. Which is exactly sort of where we're headed right now. All right, so if we take the pieces that we had on the last page, we have a harmonic solution. We choose E to be along the y direction. It only varies as a function of x because we have infinite planes here. Harmonic, because it's a harmonic function, it will vary in space and time, but it's harmonic in both space and time. So I put those boundary conditions in. It has a wavelength. It has a period. This would be an initial condition, which we're not going to worry about right now. Given what we have on the last page, what we discovered was B is perpendicular, and we do have an orientation with it. It's perpendicular. If E is along the y-axis, B can't be either along the z or the negative z. It's going to be one of them. Right? And we discovered that when we ripped apart Maxwell's equations with the solution. And what we found was that if E is in the positive y, then B is in the z. And we used Maxwell's equations where we're taking the time derivative, and we were and we pull out the constants, so you end up with B being related to E by this, and this of course is 1 over C. And we have that they're in the same phase. There's been nothing to change the phase angle, and we can set it to 0 at the moment. So then we can draw the solution for E and D, and what you find is the magnitude of E along Y is represented by these vectors if I freeze time. and that would be in the blue. It stays in the Y X plane, but it varies in magnitude harmonically with a spatial period of one wavelength. Okay? And B is in phase, so if this is a, I drew a cosine curve, this will also be a cosine curve. So it'll be out of positive Z, it'll be at right angles. And the same thing, you'll have the magnitude of B in each of these planes given by the vector. The planes are infinite. So I have not done something like draw a little photon envelope over these things. Really easy to somehow mentally fall into that trap. But that's not what this represents. Okay, and then I showed you this Java applet, which is sort of fun to use to visualize these things as it goes. And the time dependence, and I mean, it comes from the self-coupling. If I have E changing, I have B changing, and the solutions stay the same, but they have a time dependence. So you can see the time dependence by looking at what's happening in that plane at any given time. So as the wave passes through, you do have instances where you have no magnetic and no electric field, and then you have instances where you have a very strong magnetic field, and et cetera. And this is happening very fast because this speed is at the speed of light. So these fields are oscillating really, really fast. Okay? Any questions about the overall concept? Yeah.
How do you get it to work if you're turning
it to water? That was the software guys. I think it works in a couple of other browsers too. No. You may find a browser it doesn't work in.
All right.
So what I'd like to do now is to look at the energy flow in these waves. And the way that I would like to do that is to basically draw a box which has a corner on the x-axis. And as the wave passes through at any given moment, you're going to have some electric field oriented like so, and some B field maybe oriented like so, and oscillating as the wave passes through. So you think of this box as being fixed in space, and what I'd like to do is to look at the energy that's in the box as the wave passes through. So let's let this box have a width here of dx, and let's say that this box has an area which is perpendicular to the direction of the wave. It has an area on two sides, which we'll just say, I'll just call area. And we have a plane wave that's propagating in the positive x direction. So how do we know how much energy is in the box? If we know what the electric field is, if we know what the magnetic field is, then we know out what the energy density carried by the electric field is, and we know what the energy density is carried by the magnetic field. So we can basically take the energy densities, multiply them by the volume, and we have energy. So just to remind you, the energy density of the electric field is epsilon naught over 2 times the magnitude of the electric field squared, and the energy density of the magnetic field is equal to 1 over 2 times mu naught times the magnitude of B squared. And so our box is differential width dx in length, so we can only evaluate easily the differential energy in the box, so that'll be just the energy that is instantaneously in the box, and that will be the energy density in the electric field plus the energy density in the magnetic field times the volume of the box. So du is equal to epsilon naught over 2 times E squared plus 1 over 2 mu naught times B squared times the area of this box times dx. Okay, so that is the amount of energy we have in the box instantaneously. So I'm going to rewrite this thing some. So just to remind you of a few little things, we know that E is equal to CB. And we know that epsilon naught is equal to 1 over mu 0 times C squared. And we know that C is equal to 1 over the square root of epsilon naught mu naught. So we can use that to sort of manipulate this thing a little bit. So du is equal to, I'll rewrite epsilon naught as 1 over mu naught C squared. Times E squared. Then I'm going to rewrite one of the E's as B, so this will be E times C times B plus 1 over 2 mu naught, and I'll rewrite one of the B's in terms of E, so I'll have B times E over C. This whole thing goes times the area times dx. Okay with that? So this is the energy in the box, and remember that this energy is moving basically at the speed of light. So what that says is that the du in energy moves dx over a distance c in a time dt. So let me take this du and just rewrite it first. It's equal to 1 over mu naught c times E times B. I just can combine the terms because I rewrote them. This is times the area times dx. And now I want to divide by dt because I want to actually think about the column in the wave. So the energy that flows through this dx in a time dt, I can think of the power as du over dt . Let me go ahead and move the area over, so I'll have 1 over area is equal to 1 over mu naught times c times the magnitude of E times the magnitude of B times dx over dt. You okay with that? This is C. This is power. This as a whole is power per unit area, and that's what we define as intensity. Bright light is a light where you have a lot of power incident per unit, a lot of energy incident per unit time per unit area. Okay? It is less intense if you go very, very far away, because that same energy is spread, it goes as 1 over r squared because it comes out as a sphere, right? So as you go away, the intensity will drop off as the square because the area grows as the square, but it's the same energy. So you should have run into that with sound. It's the same sort of thinking. So the power is equal to the intensity, which goes as E times B over mu naught, and it will have units of watts per meter squared. And you can think of this maybe as the energy flux, right? It's the amount of energy incident per unit time per unit area. Any questions? So the energy's flowing. If I have a box that's capable of absorbing this power as it comes in, right? It's flowing into that box. If the box is sort of transparent, allows it to pass, the energy that passes through that box continues on, right? So it actually, you can think of the energy flow as having both a magnitude and a direction. So we define a vector, which is sort of the energy flow vector. And we call it the pointing vector. And that's defined as S, typically. And it is E cross B divided by mu naught. E and B are mutually perpendicular, so when you do the cross product, you just get E times B. But the direction of the energy flow is given by E cross B. And we've actually already extracted that earlier when we looked at Maxwell's equations. And we discovered that if E is along Y, when you use do Maxwell's equations, B has to be along Z. E cross B goes in the positive X direction. So if I have my box there, the energy is flowing that way. So the energy flow in the electromagnetic wave goes in the direction of the pointing vector, and the intensity is the magnitude of the pointing vector. And it is an instantaneous thing. Okay? Any questions? If there is something that gets lost in here, sometimes the rule of thumb that the name pointing vector, it's pointing in the direction that waves go. All right, this is important stuff. So if you imagine your box, sometimes E and B are very big, so you have a lot of energy in it, and sometimes E and B are zero, right, as the wave passes through, you have no energy at all. So this is actually an instantaneous thing. So we have to worry about the fact that the magnitude of S varies with time, And in fact, in the picture, I mean, we know that E and B fit harmonic functions, or harmonic functions describe E and B, so let's just go ahead and use our specific example. We know that E is equal to some E0 times the sine of omega t. I'll take out the x dependence because we're looking at a box that's a fixed x, and we just want to know how the energy is flowing through it. Given the position x, let's choose it to be x equals 0 so it falls out. And we know that B in this, if E has that solution, the magnitude of B goes as E0 divided by C, and it's in phase, so it also has sine omega t. So if I take these as my solutions, then what that tells me is that S, which is equal to the magnitude of E times the magnitude of B over mu naught, so the magnitude of S will go as E0 squared times the sine squared of omega t divided by mu naught c. You okay with that? So the fact that E and B are described by harmonic waves means that I can basically rewrite the magnitude of the pointing vector and find that I have this sine squared term describing the time dependence of it. These oscillations are happening really, really fast, so what is typically more important than the instantaneous energy flow is the time-averaged energy flow. That's really the time-averaged power, really, is what you typically have to deal with. So what I'd like to do is to time-average this. So if I take S and I do a time-average, which you might also write like this, then it will be E0 squared, the time average of a sine square is just 1/2. So this would be E0 squared over 2 mu naught times C, or C times B squared times 2 mu naught. Okay? Any questions? So if I have an electromagnetic wave, I know its magnitude of E or its magnitude of B. I know how much energy it's carrying. This would be the time average energy at any... If I take this, this would be the...
The intensity of the light, basically... on the surface. So if I have a certain area,
that would tell me how much energy I would need. So if you wanted to understand, for example, the absolute limit to food production in Iowa, you could take the area of Iowa and you could take the intensity of sunlight and calculate the energy in that sunlight. If you had 100% efficient conversion of that into corn, you could calculate the amount of corn that it takes that Iowa could theoretically produce in a given year. Okay? Because that's where it comes from.
All right, any questions on this so far? Let's imagine that we have an electromagnetic wave traveling along X, like we've been having, and now I have a charge that is just sitting out in space, and the electromagnetic wave is going to pass that region of space. So as the wave passes, At that moment, I will have, for example, an electric field that's up this way, and I'll have a magnetic field that might be so.
E cross B tells me that the power, the energy, the wave is traveling in the positive x direction. Think about this for a second. If the charge is just sitting there, the B field does nothing, but the electric field will accelerate the charge. So for a moment, you could imagine, especially since the E field grows and then peaks and then falls off, the charge is accelerated a little bit in the direction of the E field. If that's true, I now have the charge moving a little bit up. I have a B that way. V cross B gives me a force on the charge, which is along the positive x direction. Okay? As the E's and B's flip, you can sort of imagine that the charge now would be going down. V this way. B has now flipped in. So again, I get a force in the positive x direction. Okay. So let's look at that a little bit quantitatively. We'll say that the force in the x direction is equal to the change in the momentum in the x with respect to time. The force in the x direction, remember, is qv cross b, and I want to pull out the x component of that. So if I write down the cross product expression, remember it comes with these two terms times x hat, two terms times y hat, and two terms times z hat. I'm only going to pull out the x hat piece of it because I want to look at the force in the x direction. So this will be q times vy bz minus vz by. Okay. The V for this charge momentarily is going to be along the Y, not along the Z. You may argue that because you're going to get, you say that the charge is going to be accelerated along Y. So we won't have a... We also know that, I guess maybe the other way this term actually goes away, is we know that B has no Y component. It's perpendicular to E, and we've chosen E to be in the Y plane. That's actually probably the real reason this goes away.
So that term is zero. So we get D, P, and X respect to time is q dy dz. I'll rewrite bz in terms of b, because the magnitude of b in the z is related to the magnitude of e by this factor c. This becomes q over c times vy times ey. Where we've made use of that B is perpendicular to E and the magnitudes are related.
Look, this is a change in momentum, and we get this combination. Let's look at this for a moment.
Remind you that work goes as force dotted into distance that you go, right? So that might be Q times E dotted into distance, which might be a velocity, a distance divided by time, times a time. So if I have a Q times E dotted into V, basically. E and V would be in the same direction. So I have a V times an E. So think of that for a moment. So what we have with this relationship, if I take dw over dt, then it will go as q times e dotted into v, which if it's v and e are both in the y direction, this will be q times vy times ey. Make these a different color because it's a little bit of an aside. Okay? But what I'm trying to do is to use this sort of this thinking to interpret what the QVE happened to be. And what we're saying is that it's a power. So up above, then, we have that the force in the x direction, which is dp in the x over dt, is equal to 1 over c times sort of this power in the wave. So in doing that, we're basically equating the change in momentum to something that has to do with the energy that's in the wave.
We have momentum conservation, so if we... you can think of this as the change in momentum of the particle, but you can also think of it as the momentum of the wave. Right? So
P, where this is momentum, not energy, is equal to U over C, where U now is the measure of energy. So this is classically the momentum of the EM wave, is a way to think about it. Even though it is massless, it's got momentum because when it interacts with a charged particle, it will translate, it will cause it to move. So. Let us assume that the wave is entirely absorbed by some surface. So the force on that surface will be the change in the momentum with respect to time, which, because we now know what the momentum is, it goes as U over C. This will be du over dt times 1 over C . So I can rewrite this as 1 over C times the energy per unit area times area divided by time.
to, I've sort of inserted area over area in places where I want to use them. So this is energy per unit time divided by C. I have energy per unit time divided by C, and then I insert an area over an area. And if you look at this, this is energy per unit area per unit time, which is intensity. So that's going to be your pointing vector, magnitude. Okay?
So we can say that the magnitude of the force on the surface is 1 over C times the magnitude of the pointing vector times the area, or if I divide both sides by area, I have force per unit area, which is equal to pressure, is S over C.
So what this tells you is that if an electromagnetic wave is incident on a surface that fully absorbs it, it exerts a pressure that is equal in magnitude to the energy flow per unit time per unit area, energy flow per unit time per unit area divided by C. And we call this radiation pressure. Let us suppose that instead of having a surface that is fully absorbing, I have a surface that is fully reflecting. How is this going to change?
The sign is just going to change. Is it just all the pressure going back?
You're thinking about it. What will happen is, So the wave gets reflected. So I have momentum coming in this way, leaving like that. So the net change in momentum of this surface has to be a factor of 2 greater than if you just caught it. Right? It's exactly the same thing that you would have if you were throwing a ball at somebody, right? If you ask what is the change in momentum to the object the ball hits, if they catch it, all they've done is absorb the momentum of the ball. And so that's their change in momentum. If, you know, they're Superman and it bounces off, then they have to send it back with that momentum if it's an elastic collision. And so their momentum changes twice as much. So if you have a mirrored surface, so this would be if it's fully absorbing. Fully reflecting, then the radiation pressure is twice that. It's an instantaneous thing because remember that the pointing vector is instantaneous. So what is generally more useful to think about would be the time average of the pressure. And that will be the time average of S over C for absorption. Okay?
So recognizing you're a class of mutants, you probably do care about this, but let me ask you, why do you care?
That radiation can exert a pressure.
Is that related to learning the one for three.
I don't know what you're learning my like meaning through.
If the wave is quantized at that moment, and we get the pressure.
Okay, so if you want to worry about how classical and quantum mechanics relate to one another, then you might try to use this to see if you could relate to the momentum a photon might carry. Yeah, that's true. But that wasn't really what I was aiming at. Why do you care classical? Yeah.
Could you get stuff to move by shining the
light? Yeah, you can. You can use it as a method of propulsion. NASA's sent up. You could do a solar sail. Quite literally, take a big sheet of reflective mylar and have a little spacecraft that deploys it, and in fact, the light from the sun will propel it. Okay? So that's certainly true. But I'm really thinking of something much more important and much bigger. Yeah?
Use it
what?
Use solar power.
Well, the energy flow gives you solar power if you can convert it. What do you think?
It's how we perceive things.
It's how you perceive things. That's true. There's energy. I don't know if it's pressure. Probably you have quantum chemical reactions in your retina and stuff. But, so you are absorbing it. It's probably more quantum.
Is it job security?
Always job security. Yeah, that definitely is true. There's a lot of value to knowing these things. Stars. Stars start out as just big clouds of gas out in space with a very, very low density. And if you have a little bit more here than you have over here, gravity is inexorable. It's just going to pull it in. And what happens when you compress a gas is it gets hot. I don't know how many of you, if you take a spray can, if you go out, what is it called, tagging, if you go out spray paint, you know, U of R all over everything. If you take the spray can, when you push it, the nozzle gets cold, right? If you're pumping up a bike tire and you feel the nozzle after you've done some pumping, it's very, very hot. So why is this? It's because if you look at the adiabatic expansion of a gas, adiabatic means you think of it in such a way that you don't have time for heat to flow into the system or away. So if you're going to take a gas and you do the thermodynamics of a gas where you just expand it without allowing heat to flow in, the temperature drops. So if you have ever looked at what happens when you have like a CO2 fire extinguisher, it's just this bottle of really highly compressed gas, when you blast it out, you have an adiabatic expansion of the gas, and what you get out is actually dry ice because it's frozen. It freezes as it comes out because it gets so cold. Okay, so you have lots of interesting effects. So what happens if you have a tenuous gas out in space that slowly collapses and you really aren't having energy flowing in and out of this thing very much? It gets hot. So as it collapses, you also have conservation of angular momentum. So as it collapses, it'll begin to rotate and it gets hot. Slowly some of that heat will bleed out. But basically, you might ask, okay, it begins to get hot. It keeps collapsing. But the fact that you produce heat in the middle of this, I mean, heat basically is infrared radiation. We haven't talked about the spectrum yet, but it's electromagnetic radiation. So it exerts a pressure pushing outward, and it slows the collapse of the gas cloud down. You get hot in the middle, but slowly, at the edges of this gas cloud, the energy will bleed off in the form of electromagnetic radiation, infrared radiation. So it basically glows, and slowly the heat disappears. As the heat disappears, you get more collapse because you have less pressure. It gets hotter. You have more radiation coming out that stabilizes it. This process just basically keeps happening, and it gets hotter and hotter and hotter in the middle until you finally have it's so hot that the kinetic energy of the molecules are such that you can overcome Coulomb repulsion and get two nuclei close to one another, they can begin to fuse. And when that happens, you initiate fusion reactions of hydrogen in the center of the star. When you do that, it gets to be a very interesting time in the star, because now you've got a massive source of energy. Radiation is pushing out, so it gets very hot and stabilizes the gravitational collapse. All right? And so you're going to have some fun in there for a little while, because there's a lot of energy that's being produced. But eventually, you get an equilibrium between the gravitational pull of the gas, gas coming in and the radiation pressure that pushes out, which stabilizes the envelopes of the star. The star is nothing but a big hot ball of gas with nuclear reactions, fusion reactions happening at the center of the star. And you have this equilibrium between radiation pressure out and gravitational pull in. And that continues until you run out of hydrogen fuel at the center of the star. You're still burning out here because it's still very hot out here. But when you run out of the fuel in the core, the energy production in the core drops dramatically. It's now cooler. It's not pushing out anymore. Gravity starts to win. So again, the same thing happens. You start to collapse. You get hotter and hotter. The star is big enough. The hydrogen has burned into helium. If it's big enough, you'll begin to have enough energy to actually start to fuse helium in the center of the star. So in the end, if the star is big enough, you'll actually get many layers of different types of fusion going on. It'll be sort of striated. And in the center, you might be burning silicon. And you might have carbon. And you might have helium fusion happening. And out on the outer edges, you might have hydrogen burning. But it's all stabilized by the radiation pressure pushing out. If it's a big enough star, until you hit iron in the center of the star. And if you try to fuse iron atoms, iron molecules, they're not atoms, iron nuclei, it turns out that they absorb energy when you push them together. So all of a sudden, when you begin to hit iron, the fusion reactions at the center of the star stop. So you have lost this supporting pressure on the inside, and things can begin to collapse. When they begin to collapse, the inner shells get really, really hot, and you'll start fusing the crap out of everything and basically get a pressure bounce, because now these basically are explosively more so than just the fusion reactor. But, all sorts of stuff happening. Can push out explosively while the outer shells are coming in, and basically you have this big kablooey, which is a supernova if the star is the right size. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
If a star is smaller, what will happen is you will never achieve the energy to keep fusing something, and it will slowly cool down, and you'll eventually sort of burn, for example, the hydrogen out here, but maybe you never had enough energy to actually start burning. So lots of different types of stars, lots of strange things happen depending on their mass and stuff like that. But stellar evolution is real happy that we have radiation pressure. Yeah.
So what exactly is a hypernova then?
I don't know. I've never heard of a hypernova, but it sounds like I don't want to be anywhere near it. I mean, there are novas, so there are different mechanisms. A standard one is if you have a binary star system close enough that some of the gas from this star gets sort of pulled off onto this star, it'll build up, and you'll have some instabilities, and you'll have sort of an atmospheric burn, and you'll have a nova, but that's not nearly the size of a supernova. Yeah.
So, if I understood that right, you're saying that radiation from the star creates outward pressure. Is that like the general case with gases?
Yeah, I mean, if you try to heat it up, there will be anything you get hot tries to expand in a sense.
Yeah. I mean, like, how does that fit in general? Like a classical case where you look at the pressure created from temperature as the result of molecules bouncing off.
I think that's a very real thing.
if you heat up the gas in a balloon and the balloon gets bigger, I think it's primarily due to that. And I wouldn't think that that's radiation pressure per se.
So it's a force, but it's not a dominant force in those situations?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I think if you always, in principle, I mean, I feel the radiation pressure. It's not bothering me very much. But in the interior of a star, you have this big pull in. The thermal energy may also... I don't know. Fast and Watson. Anyway, yes?
What's the order of magnitude for this radiation pressure? How significant is it?
You can calculate it and you can problem stuff.
We'll do a little bit of that, because I really want you to begin to get a feeling of what some of the numbers are. And it depends a lot on the frequency, because the frequency, basically the energy carried by the wave will also depend on the frequency, that will know the power of those. When you time average coming back up, you have to be careful, because your intuition, if you have 143 equals HU, there is an energy frequency dependence. So classically, you can think of it that way, too. But a lot depends on the magnitude of the EMD, so the intensity of the source as well.
Okay, so this stuff turns out to be very important. All right. Do you know what a Polaroid lens is? How many of you have sunglasses that are Polaroid? They're more expensive often, thought to be better. Why? What makes the Polaroid lenses so cool?
Do they cut out certain direction waves?
Yeah. Polaroid lenses basically are lenses where you have organic molecules that are lined up in such a way that they will completely absorb or reflect, absorb the light where the electric field vector is oriented one direction, and allows the other to go through. Because if I have a random source of light out in the world, the E field vector is oriented all over the place, because basically it's coming from all sorts of strange processes and whatever, or reflections from whatever it is that's happening. So in general, you can think of light as coming to you as a plane wave with the E field actually oriented in all sorts of random directions as a function of time. Okay. So with that, we call that an unpolarized wave. And so if you have a device that you can use that actually cuts out all of the waves, the degree of the E that has this orientation, then clearly it's going to cut dramatically the intensity of the light. In fact, it will cut the intensity by a factor of two, because if you think of it not being completely unpolarized, but polarized this way or that way, and I cut out this, okay, then I'm only allowing that part of the electromagnetic waves that are produced, which has the E orientation this way. So I'll cut the intensity by a factor of two. So that makes it a nice thing to have. So, for example, what we have, you can see the brightness of the light. You interpret intensity is what your eye interprets as brightness. Okay, so the light coming from the projector here, unadulterated, right? It has a certain intensity, and I now pass it through what I call a Polaroid filter, which would be a sheet of plastic with these organic molecules that cuts out all of the electric field component that is in one direction. And so other stuff will come through because an electromagnetic wave that's randomly oriented, you will also have some that are completely perpendicular. Those that are partially perpendicular, you'll cut out a component of the electric field, okay, but there'll be a component that's not. So you can see that the light that comes through the filter actually is a good difference. Less bright. So I actually have the light passing through two separate Polaroid filters.
Right.
That's this light. If I take one of those filters and I turn it, they're oriented in the same direction. That is, they are each cutting out the same component of the electric field. So what that means is if I have light coming through this filter and this filter cuts out all the waves without a component that way, the light continues, it hits another filter, it is now cutting out all the waves without a component in the same direction, that second filter does effectively nothing. Okay? If I now rotate the second filter so that it cuts out all waves that are orthogonal to the ones that are cut out by the first one, then nothing should get through, right? Everything with an equal field that way gets cut out by the lower filter, everything that way gets cut out by the higher filter. And as I turn it, you'll see that happen. Supposedly. All right, so now they're perpendicular to one another, and no light gets through. As I move it, you'll see the intensity grow until it's got the same orientation as the one below. And there it is, perpendicular enough. So let me take three filters, all with the same orientation. Okay. The bottom two are oriented the same direction. Again, if I take the top one and I turn it, I should cut out all the light. And I do. Okay? Let us do that. So the bottom two are oriented one direction. The top one is oriented the other direction. There's no light intensity coming through. Now I'm going to take the middle filter and I'm going to rotate it partly. And I get light. If I rotate it all the way, I get none yet. But at 45 degrees relative to the others, I get light. I have not touched the bottom or the top and established that the bottom or the top are perpendicular like they are, but no light gets through. So what's happening?
Change the polarization of the light on the second one. The second one, that's half.
You guys are there. Let me do a visual. So the light goes through the first filter. It has an orientation. The second filter, third filter, is at right angles to it. Let's say that. So if, for example, you're trying... that's just not going to work at all. Try this a little better. Let's suppose the light is sort of traveling this way. And let us suppose that I have one filter with this orientation and the other filter with this orientation. Okay? Then the initial electric field of the light, which I'll just give a different color, we'll have some this way, some that way, some this way, some all the way around. So as the light passes through the first filter, it only allows this orientation of the electric field through. And then you hit this filter, and everything is orthogonal to that filter, so nothing gets through. Okay? But if I put at 45 degrees in here, something like this, it will take can't see this at all. Imagine, here's your eyeball, okay? And let's look at this coming at our eye. So if it's coming at our eye, the initial wave has sort of a random polarization coming at your eye. So the E field could be, has components in all directions. Then I pass through the first filter, which has an orientation like so, then the E field that I get that's coming at me will look like that. If the second filter, or the last filter, for example, has an orientation like this, there's no component of this vector that's along that direction, so nothing gets through. If, in fact, though, I put a vector in, or a filter, that's in this direction, now I have a component of this vector that's along that way, so I'll actually get a little bit of light. It will be cut in intensity, but I'll have a little bit of light get through. And now I have this filter, and at this point I now have a non-zero component of the filter that's along that way. So the second filter basically changes the direction of the polarization of the light that's allowed, to where that now has a component that's in the direction of the polarization that the last filter will accept. Okay? So that's polarization. We'll talk a lot more about that next time.
So,
yeah, that's what I'm doing. Okay, so well, that's part of what I was trying to tell you, is be careful about you know, I spot checked one, and that person had some sort of mistake or hole in page one and missed the descent. And they basically did a really good job for everything. So that person's doing fine.
That was me, I'm going to laugh.
Well, I, you know, I don't think it was. But yeah. I'm saying, so you need to look at it.
Yeah.
Think about it. So if it turns